This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Under Mugabe, the outcome of every poll was predictable. Over his decades of rule, Mugabe was accused, often and credibly, of poll rigging and intimidating voters.
That's VOA's Anita Powell reporting on Zimbabwe's political tensions. Details coming up.
Also, officials are counting the votes from Mali's runoff presidential election, and two top Kenyan government officials plead not guilty today to allegedly skimming money from a major rail project linking Nairobi to Mombasa.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Zimbabwe is at a tense standstill as the presidential inauguration has been delayed due to the opposition's legal challenge to the July 30th election results. This was the country's first election without Robert Mugabe on the ballot, and analysts are not entirely sure what to make of this moment in Zimbabwe's history. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Zimbabweans went into last month's general elections, the first in 38 years without Robert Mugabe atop the ballot, with great hopes. Even before results were announced, opposition supporters took to the streets of the capital, Harare. At first, they celebrated. Then they protested the delay in results. Finally, they ran for their lives after security forces fired live rounds, killing six people. Now, 2 weeks after the poll, the declared victor, incumbent Emmerson Mnangagwa, who took over in November after Mugabe's resignation, has still not been inaugurated. He is held in limbo as the opposition Movement for Democratic Change Alliance challenges his narrow 50.8% win. They say challenger Nelson Chamisa, who officially got 44% of the vote, won the poll. Lawyers for the party filed their case on Friday, saying they believe the poll was not conducted in terms of standards of fairness, transparency, and accountability. International observers praised the poll for being peaceful, but raised concerns over the environment around the poll and the campaign. Under Mugabe, the outcome of every poll was predictable. Over his decades of rule, Mugabe was accused, often and credibly, of poll rigging and intimidating voters. But for the first time in ages, even analysts say they're not quite sure how this will end. Professor Annie Chikwana of the University of Johannesburg.
It's a very precarious, situation, sort of like hanging over a cliff, not very dangerously, but somehow dangerously, I think, and that's because of the uncertainty surrounding what will happen once the Constitutional Court has given its verdict.
What analysts say needs to happen is unlikely. Two men from different generations, different temperaments, and different ends of the political spectrum need to come together. Chamisa has outright dismissed suggestions of entering into a government with Mnangagwa and says the two men have not spoken. Chikwana says they need to mend that bridge.
Politically, it is important for whoever wins to take in or bring in the other one on board. They may not want to do it, but there has to be some form of appeasement that would appeal to the general electorate and to the voters or the public that supports the loser.
Analysts say they hope Zimbabwe can move forward, and that this election will be a blip in that journey. Professor David Moore.
I said far in advance of the November 17 coup that this would be an election that wouldn't count. 2023 would count because the younger generation, which cut their teeth in the 2000s against the regime, are now gaining maturity, having experience, and if they can maintain a hold over the MDC and perhaps other opposition parties that might emerge, we will see a much different election.
But right now, as Zimbabwe waits, that may be cold comfort for this very divided nation. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Officials are counting the votes from Mali's runoff presidential election. The balloting yesterday was marred by low turnout and attacks on several polling stations that left one election official dead. President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita is expected to win a second term when the final results are in, which is expected by Friday. He is facing Soumaila Cissé in a runoff for the second straight election. Cissé has claimed fraud in both rounds of voting. Turnout was estimated at just 22% in one of the world's poorest countries. That's roughly half the total for the first round of balloting 2 weeks ago. Some 36,000 troops provided security support, but officials say threats from Islamic militants kept hundreds of polling stations from opening, mostly in the restive north, where the chairman of an electoral office was shot dead. Still, election monitors say the election process was mostly peaceful.
Authorities in Cameroon say they have arrested seven soldiers suspected of executing women and children in 2016 while fighting against Islamist militant group Boko Haram. Rights group Amnesty International says the arrests are a step forward, but says a deeper investigation is needed into extrajudicial executions by Cameroon's military. Moki Edwin Kinziga reports from Yaoundé.
Rights activists have welcomed the Cameroon military's arrest of soldiers accused of killing civilians while fighting the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. Ilaria Alegrozi is an Amnesty International researcher on the Lake Chad region.
The opening of investigation and arrests announced by the Cameroonian Minister of Communication appear to be a welcome step. However, the government has to show that it is serious about investigating those crimes. And we believe that to take this investigation seriously, it would have to be accompanied by a real commitment to investigate whether other similar incidents have happened.
Government spokesperson Issa Chiruma says the seven soldiers were arrested last week for the execution of two women and two children accused of supporting the Nigerian militants.
Au terme des investigations telles qu'instruites par le chef de l'État, sept personnels de
He says, following instructions from Cameroon's President Paul Biya, the seven soldiers will be tried in court. He says the fact that there are only seven suspects indicates that a very small minority of Cameroon's military might be involved in such crimes. But he says only the court will investigate and establish the truth. For now, says Chiroma, the soldiers are presumed innocent. The arrest followed the circulation online of two videos that appear to show Cameroonian troops executing civilians. Amnesty International researchers analyzed the weapons, dialogue, and uniforms in both videos and determined the perpetrators were Cameroonian security forces. Alegrozi tells VOA that Amnesty International says the military's crimes go beyond these apparent killings.
Amnesty International has already shown that the horrible crimes caught on video are just the tip of the iceberg and are part of a pattern of systematic human rights violations committed by the Cameroonian security forces in their fight against Boko Haram.
Despite the arrest, Chiruma denies Cameroonian troops were responsible for neither of the atrocities and referred to the second video as fake news.
Je rejette. Parce que si longtemps qu'on n'aura pas établi de manière incontestable l'origine et l'appartenance,
he says he totally rejects allegations that Cameroon soldiers committed the horrible crimes and summary executions of civilians in the northern town of Ashigashia, shown in the second video that has been circulating on social media. However, he says that Cameroon President Paul Biya has ordered investigations to be carried out urgently and for any suspects to be arrested. Amnesty International, in a report last year, said the military brutally tortured Boko Haram suspects and held them incommunicado in illegal detention facilities. Cameroon has described Amnesty's report as intended to give the country a bad image in the international community. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Two top Kenyan government officials and 16 other people pleaded not guilty today to allegedly skimming money from a major rail project linking Nairobi to Mombasa. The chairman of the National Land Commission and the managing director of the Kenyan Railways Corporation were among those charged with fraud totaling about $2.2 million. The new high-speed rail line is a $3 billion project funded by China. Officials say no Chinese officials or companies were charged in the fraud case, which allegedly involved faked claims of compensation of land for the project. It's the latest high-profile corruption case amid President Uhuru Kenyatta's campaign to root out endemic graft. But very few people have been prosecuted.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580, and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehigis Wuhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Zimbabwe is at a tense standstill as the presidential inauguration has been delayed due to the opposition's legal challenge. Officials are counting the votes from Mali's runoff presidential election. And rights groups Amnesty International calls for deeper investigation into extrajudicial execution by Cameroon's military. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Around the world, young people struggle to find safe spaces to learn, build their own communities, and express themselves. At a Nairobi gathering, 300 young people from around the world met to address that challenge, marking the United Nations International Youth Day. VOA's Ruben Chama reports from the Kenyan capital.
Chebet Lesan from Kenya runs a social enterprise that uses farm and paper waste to make charcoal, which usually is made by burning down forests.
Safe space for me basically is just a space where you can allow youth to innovate without judgment, to allow them to make mistakes, to allow them to interact, to allow them the process of learning. I think a safe space is one that allows the youth to find who they are, find their passions, find what their skill sets are. The reason why it's so important for them to find their passion, because a lot of the purpose of different youth is tied to their passion. So when they're able to develop that skill that they're passionate about, then they're able to reach out to the community. Once you're reaching out to the community, you're purposeful in the community, you're making a change.
In 2017, the 28-year-old Kenyan won a Young Leaders Award, awarded by Britain's Queen Elizabeth for her work.
I'm a result of a safe space. I've been incubated, I've been taken through mentorship. I have very many mentors, both locally and globally, and they mentor me on different things. One person will mentor me on how to communicate, another will mentor me on how to ask for investment. Somebody else will mentor me on how to deal with business challenges, daily business challenges. So it's very important to just be in that space where the youth are being allowed to learn. These are incredible spaces.
Lesan and other youth leaders from around the world gathered at the United Nations headquarters in Nairobi last week to share their experiences and look at ways to help their peers. The United Nations estimates there are 1.8 billion young people between the ages of 10 and 24 in the world, the largest youth population ever. But 1 in 10 of the world's children live in conflict zones, and 24 million of them are out of school. Maimuna Mohamed Sharif is the executive director of the UN Habitat.
By 2030, 70% of the population will stay in the urban areas. And even Kenya is a young nation. I was informed that 70% of its population is under the age of 30. We have to look into the plan-led development. It is very important for the young people to be included to the education, to the employment, culture, And also this is a safe space for shelter and also for mobility.
Shamoy Hajare from the Jamaica School for Social Entrepreneurship says providing young people with the opportunity to gather and participate in activities or dialogue can lead to peace and cohesion in society. Hajare says it's particularly important to look at employment.
By the year 2030, at least 1 billion new jobs will need to be created to actually facilitate the cohort of young people who are actually coming out of school. Where are those jobs going to come from? Who will create those jobs? It's a major issue because if young people don't have access to livelihoods, if they cannot find decent employment, then they're not focusing on anything else. They're thinking about the next meal.
The UN General Assembly set August 12th as an annual day to celebrate the role of young people as essential partners in change to raise awareness of the challenges and problems the world's youth face. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Nigeria's army says calm has been restored today at the airport in Maiduguri in northeastern Borno state after troops took over part of the field and fired guns in the air yesterday. Flights were cancelled for several hours until troops ended their protest over what they said were plans to send them to an area called Marte. The soldiers say they have been fighting the Boko Haram insurgents in the region for 4 years. They originally were told their deployment would be 3 years. Today, the military command in the area said there has been a misunderstanding. An army official says a few unscrupulous troops protested because they took a directive to review the deployment plans for the Maiduguri area meant longer deployments. Army officials said the incident is regrettable and the soldiers have been admonished. However, there appears to be no way to independently verify the statement. The Boko Haram insurgency has resulted in thousands of deaths in northeastern Nigeria in the past decade and has displaced tens of thousands of people.
In Tunisia, the Committee for Individual Liberties and Equality has submitted to the president proposed reforms that would protect human rights. One recommendation calling for inheritance laws to apply equally to men and women was met with anger and resentment. William Lawrence is a professor of political science and international relations at George Washington University and an expert on Tunisia. He explained to VOA's senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi why the recommendation became so controversial.
It's met with anger and resentment because it is seen by many Tunisians to violate custom, to violate local norms, and to violate inheritance formulas that are found in the Quran and central to those people's understanding of Islamic law. I think the main issue with this is that it's a top-down approach. It's a presidential commission, not even a parliamentary commission, reporting to parliament without sufficiently consulting the public or preparing the public for such a recommendation. Given that post-revolution democracy is, you know, one of the most important things that Tunisia has developed and that it needs to continue to strengthen, this type of sort of presidential top-down approach is likely not to succeed as a project. The president is, however, doing his job and the commissioner doing their job in the larger sense that they're trying to square the incredible Tunisian constitution with more problematic Tunisian laws that aren't in sync with the constitution. But I'm not sure that this way of going about it will succeed with the general public. It's really important that democracy take the upper hand, which is why some Tunisians are calling for referendums on these issues.
Another movement was accused of inciting the Tunisian public against the recommendation, but Ahmed Himeri, spokesperson for Ennahda, denied the accusations and said Tunisia should focus on social justice, employment, and economic growth, not on ideological and religious polarization. What's your take on that?
Khamedi is right that the Ennahda movement, for the most part, is not inciting the public. I think Khamiri is right that the country should be focused on social justice, employment, and economic growth. But I think Khamiri is dead wrong that this has nothing to do with social justice, employment, and economic growth. Women are the major breadwinners in Tunisia. In many cases, they have equal or even greater financial responsibilities than men. And so some formula needs to be arrived at with the support of the Tunisian population that allows women to have, and this is in accordance with the constitution, an equal footing with men when it comes to their economic position. And that involves social justice, that involves their employment and the economic growth of the country. Empowering women empowers Tunisia. So while Khamiri is trying to avoid the topic, I think, a little bit because it's controversial, in the end, Tunisia should address this type of reform, but it should be done in a way where public opinion is prepared over a much longer period and a democratic process is involved, even all the way down to town meetings all around Tunisia on this recommendation and other recommendations of the commission.
Another recommendation by the committee is to either eliminate death penalty totally or restricting it to certain cases. But the counter-terrorism laws in Tunisia allows for death penalty. How would Tunisia reconcile that contradiction?
Well, this is similar to the other issue, all of which pitting the principles of equality and equal human rights against extant Tunisia law, including the counterterrorism law, which could be seen to contradict the constitution, at least if you interpret the death penalty, you know, as a human rights issue. Tunisia has not implemented the death penalty since 1991, and so this is more of a hypothetical conversation. I think that the counterterrorism law needs to be squared against the Constitution in a sophisticated way, and there's really no reason to reintroduce it either in the legal sense or in a practical sense because it's not serving Tunisia either way. But again, this is something that may be better addressed as a national referendum, and more importantly, that involves the population and the democratic process and the decision-making rather than a more top-down approach.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science and international relations at George Washington University and an expert on Tunisia. He was speaking with VOA's senior analyst, Mohammed El-Shenawy.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
I'm Lenore Mudu, host of Health Chat. Next week on Health Chat, we will discuss acne, a condition where all glands of the skin become clogged, forming spots, pimples, and sometimes cysts. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Stand up!